It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
New video purportedly shows kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls. South Sudan delays 2015 presidential election. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram has released a video claiming to show dozens of missing schoolgirls abducted last month in northern Nigeria. In the video, Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau said the girls will not be released until the group's imprisoned fighters are freed. The violent Islamist group kidnapped hundreds of girls from a school in northeast Borno State April 14. They threatened to sell the girls on the human trafficking market. The Director General of Nigeria's National Orientation Agency, Michael Mary, said officials are studying the situation. All options remain open to freeing the missing girls.
At the moment, because all options are open, we are interacting with experts, military and intelligence experts from other parts of the world. So these are part of the options that are available to us, and many more. If it is necessary that we use whatever kind of action to get our girls out of the captivity that they are in now, we will do it.
Meanwhile, a senior U.S. official says the United States has deployed manned surveillance aircraft over Nigeria and sharing satellite imagery with the government in the search for those missing schoolgirls. The government of South Sudan says it will delay the 2015 presidential election to tackle the issue of reconciliation. President Salva Kiir said Monday the interim government will remain in power until the vote is held sometime in 2017 or 2018. Rebel leader Riek Machar said if Mr. Kiir were committed to a comprehensive peace agreement, he would organize elections next year. The two leaders met Friday in Ethiopia, signed a peace deal, but fighting flared in recent days with both sides accusing the other of breaking the truce. Thousands have been killed in the conflict that began in December. More than a million have been displaced. At UN headquarters Monday, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for a special tribunal for South Sudan, saying there are grounds to believe crimes against humanity have been committed since the violence began, and he renewed his call to honor the latest ceasefire agreement.
The fighting must end immediately. People need to be able to go back to their land to plant and tend their crops in peace. Hunger and malnutrition are already widespread. If this planting window is missed, there will be a real risk of famine. That is why we are calling for 30 days of tranquility, backed by both sides.
Mr. Ban, who visited South Sudan last week, said a UN report underscores the level of atrocities being committed by both sides. A report from the UN Secretary General suggests that Lord's Resistance Army fugitive leader Joseph Kony may be hiding in a disputed enclave controlled by Sudan that borders Central African Republic and Sudan. Kony and several of his senior commanders are wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged war crimes. Here's VOA's Margaret Bashir.
Mr. Bond's envoy in Central Africa, Abu Musa, told reporters that Kony is constantly on the move. He made the comments after briefing the UN Security Council Monday about a report on the work of the UN's Regional Office for Central Africa and areas affected by the LRA.
Kony may be in Kafia Kingi today. Tomorrow he will be in other parts of Central Africa or elsewhere. So he may have been sighted, but that doesn't mean he's permanent in those, because he knows eyes are after him. You know, we have troops who are tracking him on a daily basis.
Musa says the UN is working closely with the African Union-led regional task force on the LRA. Musa also met Monday with Sudan's UN ambassador, who he said reaffirmed that Khartoum is not harboring the rebel leader. In his report, the Secretary General says the LRA is believed to have split into several autonomous and mobile groups operating in the Central African Republic and Democratic Republic of Congo. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
In Somalia, a car bomb killed at least 11 people Monday, including soldiers and civilians in Baidoa, about 250 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu. A city one time controlled by al-Shabaab militants, there was no immediate claim of responsibility. Three mine workers reportedly killed in South Africa's Rusted Platinum Belt, where a strike is now in its fourth month. The National Union of Mine Workers says the three were attacked in separate incidents while on their way to work or attacked at home. The top three platinum companies have reported multiple acts of assault Sunday and Monday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found at our internet website, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Should Nigeria's government negotiate with Boko Haram for the freedom of the abducted schoolgirls?
If apparently that is the only thing that will ensure that these girls are brought back to their parents, to their families, then negotiation should be the way out.
Kabiru Manto heads the political science department at the University of Abuja. Nigeria arrests 5 Boko Haram suspects for bus station bombing. The African Union urges global intelligence sharing against terrorism. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expresses concern over the breakdown of South Sudan's ceasefire agreement.
If the conflict continues, half of the South Sudan's 12 million people will either be displaced internally, refugees abroad, starving, or dead by the year's end.
Last week's South Africa election results promise an interesting 5 years ahead. A Mombasa Kenyan church stands firm despite sectarian unrest. And Amnesty International says many countries systematically use torture. Those stories plus Mark Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Nigerian political analyst says if negotiation with Boko Haram would ensure the safe return of the abducted Nigerian schoolgirls to their families, then the Nigerian government should negotiate and even trade prisoners with the Islamist militant group. This comes as Boko Haram on Monday released a video which it claims shows dozens of missing schoolgirls abducted last month in northern Nigeria. Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, claims on the video that the Nigerian government has agreed to swap prisoners. Kabiru Manto, head of the political science department at the University of Abuja, says whatever method the government chooses must be done with care.
The issue about whether the authenticity of that video or otherwise, in my view, is immaterial at this material time because these over 200 girls that were abducted are still missing, and it does not appear that the Nigerian state is actually aware of where they are and what condition the young ladies might be in. And so whether government wants to really negotiate with the Boko Haram movement in order to exchange prisoners for these girls or not is another thing altogether. And I think the most important thing is that the government in Abuja must agree that it's responsible for the failure of the security agencies in the northern region, despite over 11 months of state of emergency, where the military and other security institutions are in charge of all security matters in the region, have not been able to, up to this moment, satisfactorily, I'd say, bring this crisis to either an end or to a manageable proportion.
Professor, listening to you, you seem to agree with some Nigerian government officials that they are as concerned as you are about the plight of the girls, and they are saying they want to do everything to bring the girls back to their families.
Yeah.
The question is, how do you do that? Do you do it through military means, or do you negotiate? And in this way, should Nigeria negotiate and swap prisoners?
If apparently that is the only thing that will ensure that these girls are brought back to their parents, to their families, then negotiation should be the way out. But like I said, I'm afraid of a situation where wrong tactics will be deployed, and any application of wrong tactics in this matter could result in very severe consequences that will be of grave political implication to the government on one hand, and on the other hand, that will inflict tremendous hurt and harm on these girls and the families.
The U.S. government and Britain have offered to help the Nigerian government. Even the Nigerian government has said that it has accepted an Israeli government offer to join in the hunt for these girls. What do you make of this international response?
The reality is that it appears as if the international community is even more worried about what is happening in this country and is prepared to provide the leadership due to the inactivity on the part of the Nigerian state. But one fact that this intervention by lots of America and other governments seems to suggest is that it is a tacit acceptance on the part of the Nigerian state that it is incapable of rescuing these girls and therefore, by implication, incapable of bringing this insurgency to an end.
Kabiru Mato, head of the Political Science Department at the University of Abuja, was speaking with me from Abuja. The Nigerian government is offering a $150,000 reward for information useful in the search for two men they say masterminded an attack on a bus station that killed 75 people last month in the Nigerian capital. As Heather Murdoch reports for VOA from Abuja, authorities have five other men in custody on charges related to the attack.
The Nyanya bus station was bombed April 14th as suburban commuters loaded into buses and minivans to head to work in Abuja. Later that day, the news began to circulate that hundreds of teenage girls had been kidnapped in the northeast, far from the Nyanya bombing. It was the first attack on the capital in 2 years and the bloodiest in the city's history. Islamist militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the bombing and the kidnapping. 2 weeks later, the bus station was bombed again, killing 19 more people. Nigeria's State Security Service's spokesperson, Marilyn Ogar, addressed journalists Monday in Abuja.
Nigerian security forces shall not rest on their laurels until every individual or group of persons involved in the Nyanya bombings are brought to book.
Before bringing out five suspects to be photographed and questioned by journalists, she said the suspects were told the bombing was in retaliation for the killing of a Boko Haram member the week before at the bus station. But she says that killing never happened. She says security forces are still searching for the alleged masterminds of the first Nyanya bombing, Rufai Abubakar Siga and Aminu Sadiq Oguache, a UK-born son of a retired colonel who was previously arrested on terrorism-related charges. But she says lower-level Boko Haram militants are still hiding among the population in Abuja.
Terrorist elements are disguising daily by taking up various businesses and menial jobs in Abuja and its environs. Therefore, security awareness of the public and prompt response to information sharing will continue to play pivotal roles in the war on terror.
Boko Haram has killed thousands of people in 5 years of insurgency in attacks on churches, mosques, schools, markets, villages, and the government. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The deputy chairman of the African Union has called for robust international cooperation and intelligence sharing to help defeat terrorism on the continent following the abduction of Nigerian schoolgirls by the militant group Boko Haram. The AU has condemned the abduction of the schoolgirls and expressed concern about their plight. AU deputy chairman Erastus Muecha tells reporter Peter Clotty that the increase in cross-border crimes, including terrorism, are challenges to peace and security on the continent.
First, as you say, this is really a very unfortunate incident, taking young girls, robbing their future, and also the agony that this presents to the families and the nation of Nigeria and the humanity as a whole is indeed beyond description. As African Union, we have, of course, condemned it, and we have said that we will work with the government of Nigeria to do everything possible to help Nigeria recover the girls. That is for the immediate, and that is for this particular incident. This is precisely what we've been talking about, that terrorism, which also combines with human trafficking, drug trafficking, and other ills, are indeed on the rise in Africa, and they are a cause of challenges to peace and security.
What is the cooperation from the international community working in collaboration with the African Union to address some of these challenges of peace and security on the continent?
First and foremost is to share information, and also whenever we get to know the systems or networks that they use, either in sending funds, we should take action. And we should also work together, because most of these work cross borders, for us to be able to fight it and be determined to root it out. And that, of course, would also require that not only sharing intelligence, but also supporting each other logistically and all other avenues. But also, if we arrest them, we should be able to cooperate with each other so that we fight this scourge back as much as we can.
What have you seen as the cooperation, intelligence sharing, and military cooperation between continental member states to ensure that member countries cooperate to crush this new phenomenon?
There is a growing and a robust system of cooperation among the member states. at regional level, and this is also taking root at continental level. Of course, this requires very sophisticated networks that can be able to counter the activities of the terrorists. And of course, that's why the international community comes in, because obviously, if you think of, say, the movement of these 270 girls, somebody can be able to see it on satellite, how they are moving, how they moved, and all that. But we don't have that capability.
Erastu Mwecha is the deputy chairman of the African Union. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 13th. The time now is 15 minutes past the hour. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says he is concerned about breaches to South Sudan's ceasefire agreement signed Friday in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
Mr. Ban told the UN Security Council Monday that President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar must work together to heal the country and end the violence that has killed thousands of civilians since December.
If the conflict continues, half of the South Sudan's 12 million people will either be displaced internally, refugees abroad, starving, or dead by the year's end.
The two South Sudanese leaders met Friday in Addis Ababa and signed a peace deal. But fighting has flared in recent days, with both sides accusing the other of breaking the truce. The Secretary General told reporters that the onus is now on the two leaders to set aside their power struggle and accelerate momentum for peace.
I ask the Security Council they should continuously be engaged and render strong political messages, including taking necessary measures.
Necessary measures is often diplomatic shorthand for sanctions. Last week, Mr. Ban made an unannounced one-day visit to the capital, Juba. He met with President Kiir and then visited displaced civilians sheltering at a UN base where 20,000 people have sought protection from the fighting.
I was appalled at the conditions they are having to endure, which are worse than in any of the many refugee camps I have visited around the world, including the refugee camps for Syrian people.
The UN mission has taken in 80,000 displaced persons seeking emergency protection at its bases across the country. Mr. Bond said the bases are not intended as camps, but that the UN is working to make them safer and more hygienic. He said the government and opposition must cooperate to allow humanitarian aid to reach those in need, and he urged respect of a proposed 30 days of tranquility to allow civilians to return home for the planting season, as fears grow about a possible famine. The UN and Norway will co-host a donors conference for South Sudan on May 20th in Oslo. Last week, the UN mission in South Sudan issued a report saying there are reasonable grounds to believe both sides have committed crimes against humanity during the conflict. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
With South Africa's national elections settled, the country is looking at its most fractious parliament in years, with a surging opposition representation. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg looks at what the future may hold for South Africa.
South Africa's longtime ruling party, the African National Congress, easily won the election battle, taking 62% of the nation's votes in last week's election. But with the surge in opposition representation in parliament, the next 5 years in South Africa promise to provide great political entertainment. In terms of legislation, what happens in the next 5 years largely boils down to the decisions of the ANC, which won 249 of 400 parliamentary seats. But since the ANC does not get along with its biggest rival, the Democratic Alliance, that result has made unlikely kingmakers of the rowdy far-left upstart Economic Freedom Fighters, which grabbed 6% of the national vote. The EFF is led by rabble-rousing politician Julius Malema, who was kicked out of the ANC several years ago. Analyst Aubrey Mashinkumi says the fact the ANC lost its former two-thirds majority may force it to seek some strange bedfellows.
If the ANC needs a two-thirds majority to pass certain laws or to change the constitution in certain ways, because it did not get a two-thirds majority on its own, it might have to negotiate with Julius Malema so that together, the ANC and the EFF can get such a two-thirds majority.
Critics of the ANC say it needs all the help it can get. Party leader President Jacob Zuma is entering his second term with a target on his back, a corruption scandal in which he is accused of spending $23 million of public money to renovate his private home. A The parliamentary investigation was dropped days before the vote because Mr. Zuma's party said there was not enough time to complete their work before the election. Mr. Zuma's critics in parliament, and there are more than ever before with the ANC coming out of this vote, losing 15 seats, are expected to renew attacks on the president's integrity. The nation's largest opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, continued to pick up supporters, winning about 22% nationally. But days after the election, the party suffered a big loss when outspoken, quick-witted DA parliamentary leader Lindiwe Mazibuko announced she's leaving to study at Harvard. DA spokesman Musi Maimane says the party will go on without her. Maimane says the party will focus on efforts to gain supporters, particularly in urban areas like Johannesburg, where the ANC barely hung on to its majority. Mr. Zuma has previously described his nation as a young democracy, one that is figuring out what it wants to be. Those awkward years, it seems, are coming during his second term. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A government crackdown on Muslim militants may be having unintended consequences for some Christian churches in Kenya. For the past 2 years, a Salvation Army church has been the target of attacks by young Muslim men, angry at what they consider a harsh police crackdown on potential militants. Mohammed Yusuf has more from the coastal city of Mombasa.
The Salvation Army Church has stood in Majengo neighborhood of Mombasa since late 1920s. In recent years, the church has been attacked by Muslim youths who have fought with police to protest the deaths of clerics and young men in the government's crackdown on Al-Shabaab militants. Damage is still visible from an attack last October when attackers threw gasoline bombs at the church, burning down its training hall and a store. 6 months later, security concerns mean at least two police officers are assigned to protect more than 100 worshippers every Sunday. Despite the threats, 51-year-old Mary Ivusa still comes to the church, but worries about possible new attacks.
Fear is too much in our lives. Because as mothers, we come with the little children who cannot even run, they're still very young. So it's fear which is in our lives. And that is what has made us now to have fear when there is not enough security.
In April, two gunmen stormed a church in Mombasa's Likoni neighborhood and opened fire, killing four worshippers and injuring 15 others. Ivusa, a mother of three, says that attack made many people too afraid to come to church.
For me, I've never missed, but there are so many women who don't come because they're afraid. They don't know what will happen next, especially when you see that one which happened in Likoni. It has even brought more fear. So many mothers have not come.
Since that attack, the government has provided security for churches, especially in coastal towns. Regional security analysts say some Muslim youths direct their anger at churches because of the disappearances and killings of Muslim clerics and youths accused of having links to terror group Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Mombasa, Kenya.
Amnesty International says governments around the world are failing to keep the promises they made in the 1984 UN Convention on Torture. As Henry Richwell reports for VOA from London, Amnesty International says many countries are using torture systematically on a vast scale.
In his home city of Port Harcourt in Nigeria, Justin Ijeoma is known as Mr. Human Rights. In a region with high rates of poverty and crime, Ijeoma offers support to people arrested and held by authorities. He says many of the younger, poorer detainees suffer police brutality and torture. He describes the torture police allegedly carried out on one detainee accused of kidnapping.
He was handcuffed. Also, his two leg was handcuffed. Then they brought his two leg and hand, tied together. Then use a bar of iron crossover. So he was folded like this, and they hanged him. And they used machete to flog his back.
Nigerian authorities deny the allegations. Ijeoma says he has himself been tortured on several occasions, and it leaves deep mental as well as physical scars.
He can feel the pain afresh only just when you remind him about what they go through.
It's been 3 decades since 155 countries signed the 1984 United Nations Convention Against Torture. But Michael Bochenek, Senior Director of Law and Policy at the human rights group Amnesty International, says many of the signatories are ignoring the pledges they made.
In many cases, what we're talking about is the systematic use of torture in these countries. So there really is a divergence between people, the commitment on paper and the reality in practice.
Bochynek says there are basic steps governments need to take to end the use of torture.
Conducting effective medical investigations, ensuring that lawyers are able to visit clients in detention and do so immediately, making sure that family members have access to their relatives.
In Nigeria, 50% feared torture if arrested. The lowest figure was in Greece, where just 1 in 10 respondents think torture is sometimes necessary. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. African champion Isaac Makwala won the 400 meters in a Botswana national record of 44.92 seconds at the South Africa Open Athletics Championships in Tlokwe, Northwest Province on Saturday. Molefe, California's old record stood at 45.23 seconds. Makwala reckons the record is no surprise.
Yeah, the race was very good, and I was expecting the tight. This year I started very well. You know, I never start like this on my season. I started with 46.0. My second race was in Mauritius, 45.4. I started the heat good here. I ran good race, 45.8 heat, semi-final 45.43. And I knew that in the final everything can happen.
You're the Africa champion from Benin. The Africa Championships is coming again very shortly in Morocco, where they'll choose the Continental Cup. Any thoughts about that event?
Yeah, you know that Commonwealth is the first one. I know the Commonwealth, I want to be in top three, and I want to defend my champion in Morocco in African Champs. I know I want to make it in the Continental Cup.
That was Isaac Makwala, Botswana's Africa 400-meter champion, speaking in Tlokwe, Northwest Province, South Africa. Staying in Tlokwe, Botswana's former Africa Junior 400-meter champion, Paco Seribe, was runner-up to Makwala in 45.04 seconds and also inside the old record. Seribe reveals the secret to their success.
Isaac is my training partner. We've been together at the beginning of this season. So I think me and him, we're helping each other to become bigger athletes. As we saw earlier on the heats and semifinal, we're just cruising through to the final. So I think we have got the momentum. So now I think we can face the world now.
As a junior, you made your mark on the African continent, but as a senior, you have not quite made it. Is this the year for you to make the grade, either at Commonwealth or Africa Championship?
When I was a junior, back then I was still in school. I had to attend classes, but now I'm done with school. Now I'm just concentrating on my training, me and Isaac, because of us coming to training every day, I think it helped us a lot.
That was Paco Seribe, Botswana's former Africa Junior 400-meter champion, speaking in Tlokwe, Northwest Province, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. A listener mail for this Tuesday morning comes from Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear VOA, I think African leaders should honor with some urgency the invitation by French President Francois Hollande to meet in Paris later this week for a summit on how to deal with Boko Haram. This is a welcome development." Thank you, Ambrose Agio of Makurdi in Benin State, Nigeria, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. That's it for this Tuesday, May 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butterson. Have a lovely day.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
From Washington.